welcome. It's good to see you here. You may notice that the title changed from what was printed in the manual. Well, I've changed it again. So instead of talking about DevOps, whatever, I'm going to do a talk on how you can use HoloLens to make your development process better. Seriously, they don't even give me access to a HoloLens. So someday I'd love to give that talk, but it's not going to be today. So I guess I'll fall back to talking about DevOps. All right, my name is Brian Harry, and I'm responsible for Team Foundation Server, Visual Studio Online, and Application Insights. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time today talking about what we've been doing in that area and how we've been trying to drive DevOps forward. I'm going to try to use the vast majority of this time to do demo and try to keep the slides pretty short. In fact, we had a run-through this morning, and the dry run of the demo was 4 hours. So we're going to try to cram it down into an hour, but I may not succeed. So just a few slides to set context. And I think the thing we've been talking about now for a while is the invariant in sort of the world of IT these days is everybody needs things faster. IT is so critical to the fundamental success of the business that we need it faster and faster and faster. And every year, it accelerates. Competition is strong. And the difference, the sort of the speed at which organizations can react to changes in business model, in customer preference, in competition, sometimes the difference between success or failure can be weeks or months of ability to respond to those changes. So it's incredibly important that we figure out how to make our process, our IT process, incredibly efficient from the observation of a customer behavior or a competitor change through to software working in production and supporting new business processes. So when we think about how we do that, it's hard. And there's a lot of problems in trying to do that. Everybody's frustrated. The business is frustrated because they're not getting it fast enough. The end users are often frustrated because they're not happy with the experience. The managers are frustrated because they don't know what's going on. The developers are frustrated because they're sort of tied down with red tape. Everybody's unhappy. Result is a lot of delays. Lots and lots of software projects are late or delivering the wrong thing. And this is often caused by really not understanding what it is the customer wants. Kind of the old mentality of software development was, you know, dream it up and then go build it and then deliver it and hope the customer's happy. And to sort of be able to react in this sort of modern world of rapidly changing requirements, you really have to be much more iterative. You have to deliver in much smaller increments. You have to partner with your business. You have to partner with your customer. And you have to learn constantly from what they need and what they're doing. You need to observe what they're doing. You need to be able to try new things, see if they work. If they do, invest further in them. If they don't, abandon them and move on to another idea. So this inefficiency, this sort of these difficulties in the software development process are incredibly expensive for the business. All across the business, no matter what role you're in, it creates issues. So these are some statistics that we've pulled down from analysts, et cetera, to sort of highlight some of these issues. So 40% of implementations end up with significant amounts of rework. That is, of course, expensive both in the time to do it, but even more expensive in the lost time to market and the lost ability to respond to the customer. Of course, you know, another huge issue is production outages. On average, a production outage costs businesses $100,000 per hour, and that the average outage is 200 minutes. That's huge. That's a huge amount of money in issues in production. So the more you can prevent those issues, the more you can repair those issues quickly. If you can shrink that time, if you can reduce the impact of the issues, all of these things can save you a ton of money. To help with this, 3/4 of software development teams now have adopted agile practices. So these are practices that allow you to iterate rapidly, to engage with your customer, to get feedback early, and to measure the success of what you're doing. And all of the data, I'm not going to go through all this because it makes my head explode, ultimately says that success of the IT process is one of the foundational pillars in driving the business forward, and that we've got to be really good at it, we've got to get really good at it. We've got to get efficient, we've got to get iterative, and we've got to make sure we're delivering what the business needs when they need it, what the customer wants when they want it. So, you know, I often do like a whole hour talk on sort of our journey through Agile and DevOps, and I'll do a very, very sort of abbreviated 2-slide version of it. You know, about 5 years ago now, were sort of a standard ISV organization. We would ship every couple years. We would go through our requirements gathering phase. We would deliver a product in a beta, and then we'd sort of try to incorporate the feedback, although by that point we were already so late and behind schedule that we really didn't have time to incorporate that much feedback, so most of the feedback went into the next release that was 2 years away. It was kind of a pretty sucky way to do software, but it was the state of the art, certainly 5 to 10 years ago. And over the last 5 years or so, we've made a pretty substantial transformation in the way we build software. We now ship software every 3 weeks. Every 3 weeks, we deliver not just bug fixes or patches. We do that every day as necessary. But essentially, main, the branch that all the developers are checking into, ships to production every 3 weeks. We roll those changes up every 3 months, and we deliver them as an on-premises product that people can install on their own system. Now, that requires a little more overhead in testing for on-premises. And we have a very iterative development process that allows us to have kind of a long-term vision. We sort of, what we call our 18-month vision, sort of broken down into chunks and then ultimately delivered in 3-month increments. So align the business on the vision and then allow the individual teams to execute rapidly with their customers. So we've got sort of a long video version of this with me and some of the people on my team on visualstudio.com. You can check out if you're interested in more about how we went through that journey. So DevOps has sort of I break it down into 4 major areas. One is planning, sort of that is, what am I going to build? How am I going to manage the process of building it, knowing if I'm on track, knowing whether I'm actually succeeding. The process of actually developing and testing it, how am I getting something quality? How do I know it's good? How do I know it'll scale? How do I know it's going to be reliable? The process of release, having built it, how do I get it into production quickly, repeatably, reliably, all of that. And then monitoring and learning. And that's sort of the latest and newest part of the DevOps lifecycle. And I think most organizations are still trying to come to grips with exactly what that means. The sort of consumer web guys are the furthest ahead there, but it's really about understanding what's happening to your production, to your application in production, whether it's crashes or it's performance issues or it's usability issues, but actually watching and measuring what's happening in production, bringing that data back into the engineering team, understanding what are the things you can do to make your application more successful for your customer, and then evolving into this notion of experimentation where I'm going to try things and I'm going to measure the result of that success of that thing and then react. So now I'm going to go into demos. That's my whole preamble. And the rest of the talk, almost all the rest of the talk, is going to be demos. So I was going to start off by talking to you about some of the work that we've been doing to help the planning process. How many of you have ever used Team Foundation Server? All right, a pretty fair number. How many of you have used or ever used Visual Studio Online? Okay, smaller, but a fair number. So I'll sort of comment on this, but most of what I'm going to show you is in Team Foundation Server 2015 and is already live on Visual Studio Online today. So I encourage you to go and check it out. All right, so let's switch over to a demo machine. All right, so if you've seen TFS or Visual Studio Online, then you know we've got a web UI. That web UI is getting richer and richer by the day. Kind of the home of that web UI is a project homepage that provides you a way to sort of track the status of your team. About 6-9 months ago, we added the ability to create and pin charts to your homepage as a great way to share kind of your project state. One of the areas we've been working on very heavily lately has been on the agile planning part, particularly on the boards. So let's start by looking at the Kanban board. We've had a lot of improvements on that in certainly the last few months. So a Kanban board is basically a way to manage a backlog. You have over here on the left sort of the list of all of the items on your backlog. And you then sort of drag items across to the right as you make progress on things. So I'm going to start that item, and I'm going to drag an item over from approved to spec and gradually move things across the board. So we've been working hard on making this experience richer. So one of the things that we did is added a really easy ability to just add backlog items directly on the board. And of course, you can click on it and open it. We've also added on-card editing so that all the fields displayed on the card I can quickly edit without having to open the item. We've been working on the columns. We've had for a while this user-configurable ability to add columns, but Kanban, if you really follow the Kanban process, Kanban is a pull process. So basically, if something is in the approved state, someone who is ready to spec something will pull something out of the approved state into the spec state. And if you're going to do pull process, you need to be able to tell which things in the current state are currently in progress versus which are the things that are done and ready to be pulled. So we recently added the ability, as you'll see, to have these doing and done columns so that you can differentiate those two. So now someone in the in-progress state can pull an item off of the spec done state. And come over and work on it. We've also added the ability to customize the cards. So you can see, here I've got the title, who it's assigned to, and a custom field for the state. I've got over here also tags on the card. So you just can go over here and very easily customize a card. So you can customize the bugs and the product backlog separately if you want. You can configure it whether to show an ID, how you would like the user to show up with the avatar and the full name or just the avatar, whether or not to include the effort, whether or not to include the tags. And then you can also add custom fields. So let's say I wanted to add the area path to all of my cards. So it's super easy. Now I've got the area path on those cards. Another thing that we've done, a common request, is a good way to be able to share with the team sort of the definition of done. So what does it mean for something to be finished and ready to move to the next state? So we added this definition of done, which I can click on, and it'll, for everybody to read, you can have links in it and formatting. If I go over, instead of looking at customizing cards, look at customizing the board. Here I can add new states, here's where I do the split column if I want the doing and done on that. And I can also edit, I'll show one that has an interesting one, the definition of done, which is markdown. So you can use the markdown textual representation to get it to format it nicely in the web UI. So the Kanban board keeps getting richer and richer in terms of its ability to customize and meet your needs. We've also been working on the task board. So you'll see that All of those same capabilities are here in terms of being able to customize how they look. The task board is sort of a hierarchical board where you've got generally user stories on the left and tasks on the right. One of the things people have been asking for a while is the ability to, let me see if I can find it real quick, the ability to have bugs on their task board. Of course, some teams want to treat bugs like tasks. Some teams want to treat bugs like product backlog items. There's all kinds of different theories or philosophies on how you want to treat bugs. So we kind of said, hey, we'll give you some options. So we've now made it that I can either choose to treat bugs on the task board like requirements, and they'll show up on the Kanban board like product backlog items or requirements, and on the task board as well. Or I can treat them like tasks, and they won't show up on the product backlog, and they'll show up on the task board with the tasks. Or I can not have bugs on my backlog at all if I want to treat them that way. So we give you a lot of flexibility in terms of how you do that. So there's sort of an overview of some of the recent work we've been doing on the boards. We, of course, use this ourselves. We use Visual Studio Online and Team Foundation Server to manage our own work. And one of the tools that we use is User Voice. So we have a User Voice site, visualstudio.uservoice.com. I strongly encourage anyone who has a suggestion or an idea to go out there and post it. By far and above, the number one requested feature for Team Foundation Server is the ability to rename a team project. It's kind of embarrassing that it's taken 10 years, but I am proud to say that online on visualstudio.com today and in the release candidate for TFS that we released last week, we now have the ability to rename a team project. Finally. And, while I'm sort of talking about User Voice, about 6 or 9 months ago, I announced, I think it was at our launch event in the fall, I announced that we were sort of embarking upon this effort to open up TFS and VS Online, make it more extensible, embrace sort of web interop standards, and I showed, and we'll sort of briefly show again, that we can use those mechanisms with User Voice to link User Voice and VS Online. So here I've got my rename project in TFS. This is as a User Voice moderator. This is what I would be looking at. I can see all the user comments on it. I can simply go over to the update status menu and click link to Visual Studio Online, and that will allow me to connect that to a work item in Visual Studio Online. And from then on, updates to the Visual Studio Online work item will be reflected back to the User Voice moderator, who can then use that to update the customer. So that is one example of a whole set of integrations that we've built. If you go to integrate.visualstudio.com is a great way to look at tons and tons that we've built. So from Campfire to LeanKit to Trello, Tasktop, we've done a ton. And these are the ones we've specifically built. Two of these stand out as different than everything else, Azuqua and Zapier. Those actually are connectors. So they're not an end user app. They are things that allow you to connect one app to another app using web standards. And through Zapier and Azuqua, we connect to hundreds of other apps. So you can use tons and tons of other apps with Visual Studio Online now. And the really good news is that all that REST, OAuth, service hook stuff that we did in Visual Studio Online to enable that is now shipping in TFS 2015. So you're now going to be able to use all of these integrations with your on-prem TFS server as well. So that's cool. All this REST and OAuth and service hook stuff is a great way to tie two services together and do notifications and auto updates and cool stuff like that. But it doesn't really give you a unified experience. It's not going far enough. So we knew when we were doing it that we were going to have to eventually take the next step, and that was to enable people to build add-ons directly into the VS Online web UI. And that's been another very common customer request for a while. So I'm happy to say that we're doing that. Now, we're really, really early, and I want to warn everybody here to contain your irrational exuberance. Right now, I'm going to show you what we're doing, but I also want to warn you that we're really just looking right now for people who want to build extensions. There's no way to consume them. You can't consume anything you didn't build. The vision is eventually there'll be this ecosystem or marketplace of extensions, but we're early on in the process, and right now I'm looking for people who want to go build some stuff. So let me start by showing you kind of what this is and give you an example of what this might look like. So my team has built a sample, as it were, which is a team calendaring extension. So it's just a simple calendar to show what's going on in my team. So if you go to the admin UI for Visual Studio Online, you'll find a new tab called Extensions. And here I've got the team calendar extension installed. If I'm building, we didn't fix that. That's all right. If I'm building an extension, I can click that install button. It'll let me upload a JSON manifest for my extension. My extension could just talk to TFS or VS Online. It could talk to a third-party service. Lots of things it can do. So let's look at the team calendar. So if you look at home, you'll see a new hub here called calendar. So there is no code in VS Online that renders a calendar. It is purely 100% an extension. By uploading that JSON file into the extensions tab, this calendar hub has shown up. So that's one of the things you can do is add hubs. And you can add hubs at different levels in the experience. So let's go to the calendar. So it's kind of what you would expect. I've got a calendar. You can see it's kind of faint, I suspect, on that. But I can see that we're currently in Sprint 4. And Sprint 4 is kind of colored here to show what the duration of this sprint is. The calendar is reading data out of my team days off, which our sort of sprint capacity planning thing allows you to enter for people what their days off are. So we now read that out, and we render that on the calendar. It also allows you to just add random items to the calendar. So let's say I want to add an event, and we'll say, hey, we've got Ignite coming up. And it goes from the 4th to the 8th. And so now Ignite shows up on the calendar. Over here, we've got sort of a cheat sheet in tabular form of the same of a lot of the same information. So my goal is to show you what you can do. You essentially, when you write an extension and you plug in a tab, you own that entire hub. It's yours, and you go do whatever you want on it. Call out to other web services, etc. We also enable you to hook various events. So if, for example, you were in the code hub and you wanted to do some action on a file, we enable you to add actions, for example, to these menus. So you'd be able to add custom actions, find out what file the user had clicked on, and go do whatever it is you'd like to do. Now, we do provide the necessary and appropriate infrastructure to allow you to contain what an extension can do. So when you authorize an extension, you explicitly grant it what permissions. I'm going to give it read permission to my work items. I'm going to give it read-write permission to my work items. So you can control what those extensions allow to do. As I say, eventually our plan is to have a marketplace where you can go, people can provide free extensions, people can sell extensions, and you will very easily be able to go as part of your experience Go explore what extensions are available, and with one click, install them into your account and have them working. Now, this is on VS Online only. So I talked about the REST and OAuth and service hook stuff. We announced for VSO about 9 months ago. Now it's available on-prem. This new web UI extensibility is now going to be available on VS Online, and then we'll get it into TFS on-prem in one of the TFS 2015 updates, but it won't be in RTM because it, quite honestly, is not going to be ready. All right, so the next thing that I wanted to show you, so an important part of sort of this planning aspect, and quite honestly, a lot of aspects of the life cycle, is sort of reporting and visibility and sort of access to data about what's going on in your project. So, and this has particularly been an issue with VS Online. TFS has a very rich data warehouse that you can do a lot with. VS Online has had no reporting story other than a very simplistic charting capability. And if you wanted sort of any kind of richer capability than that, you were kind of left out. So we've recently, just in the last few days, enabled Power BI to work with your Visual Studio Online account. So here I've got, and this is just the beginning, and for now what we've done is focused on code, so I'm going to show you a bunch of dashboards with code metrics. We've also got work item tracking metrics coming. So that'll be in about 3 weeks we'll be able to show you work item tracking metrics in Power BI. So here I've got a dashboard in fact, this is the Visual Studio Online account. This is where my team develops Visual Studio Online and Team Foundation Server. I can see who my top committers are. I can see pull requests. So pull requests are basically code reviews. I can see who's working on, who's done how many of them, commits by repo, etc. So I can drill into pull requests and drill into a more detailed report to see what all is happening with those pull requests. I can see how long on average it takes pull requests to get answered. I can see which repos had the most pull requests. I can drill in because I see there were a whole bunch of pull requests in the VSO repo. And I can drill into that and filter the data down to just that set of pull requests, see who did those pull requests, etc. So a very rich interactive dashboard for understanding your VSO data. You know, another really cool thing about Power BI. So Power BI is this very, very rich system for being able to suck data from a whole bunch of different places. VS Online is just one of many places that I can suck data from. And it allows this sort of rich charting capability. But it also has this thing called Power Q&A, which is really cool. It provides a sort of natural language way to query your data. And we've created a data model for VS Online. And you know, here's a simple one that says show PR, so PR stands for pull request, show PR completion rate in the last 30 days. And so that's cool, so 73% have been completed. Let's trend that data, so I can say by week in 2015. Oops. There we go. And I can see, okay, it's kind of all over the place. Sometimes it's high, sometimes it's not. Let's take a look at, in February, we had a bunch of pull requests. Let's find out what was happening in February. So let's look at slow pull requests in February. So here they are. I say, oh my gosh. So some of them like 2,190 hours, 1,914 hours. That doesn't sound good. So let's drill in a little bit further and see what the status of those were. So let's look at the pull requests end their status in February. And I can see that, wow, all those long ones, they're all still active. So it's May, and all those pull requests from February are still active. That's not good. I don't want code reviews sitting out for months. They should either get reviewed and closed, or they should get canceled. So I could take this report and very simply pin it to my dashboard and share that with my team. So Power BI is this very cool reporting capability that allows you to mash up data from a bunch of places. We've built a connector that allows you to connect your VS Online account. We've populated it with code data for now, work item tracking soon after, testing and build data soon after that. And for now, starting with VS Online, we'll get into one of the TFS 2015 releases. Will include this ability for on-premises as well. All right, so that's high level, the stuff I wanted to show you around the planning phase. Let's go back to slides for just a second. And, you know, so the, there we go, it's going. Planning is important, but boy, if you don't actually create the app, no amount of planning actually matters. So, the process of developing is a much broader than it was 10 years ago. We think of quality as being an inherent part of the development process rather than as an afterthought. So what I wanted to do is walk through a bunch of the work that we've been doing to help you build quality into your development from the beginning. So I was going to walk you through a bunch of 2015 features that enable you to do that. We're going to start in Visual Studio. Let me close that out. There we go. So in Visual Studio, so I've got this app open called My Shuttle, which is an app for helping me find rides between various places. And so I've got it open. I've got one of my files open. And one of the things I'll notice is we have this feature in Visual Studio called CodeLens that allows me to bring information about my development team, about my code, directly into the editor. It allows me to do things, for example, I've got my team activity indicator that allows me directly from the code to look at this and say, hey, who works on this code? Like, who are the people who know about this code? I've got a question about it. I can click on the team activity indicator. It'll show me all of the people who've done check-ins into that code recently. I can even I can hover over it, and I can see what the check-in is. I can right-click. I can drill into that commit. I can even go and look at what changes that they made. So I can learn all about this code directly from where I am in my code, sort of starting directly code-focused in the editor. So you might say, woohoo, we've had CodeLens for now a couple years. What's exciting about that? Well, there's a couple things that are exciting about CodeLens. First of all, we continue to build out the list of indicators. The TeamLens indicator that I just showed you is pretty new and pretty cool. We continue to build it out in terms of working both on Team Foundation version control and with Git and with TFS on-premises and with Visual Studio Online. And we're just about to the point where we're now at parity with all of those things, so all of the capabilities work across all of those things. And the most exciting thing of all is CodeLens has been a feature that we had in our Visual Studio Ultimate Edition. And coming in 2015, CodeLens is now part of Visual Studio Pro and up. So everybody gets access to this really cool heads-up display information right in the editor. So I'm very happy about that. All right, so what's next? Let's talk a little bit about testing. So everybody does unit testing, right? Unit testing is an incredibly important part of the development process. If you don't do unit testing, you're probably not writing very good code. It's important. But who's ever inherited code from somebody else that maybe wasn't so careful about writing unit tests? Anybody ever had that happen? I've had it happen a few times. And maybe they're gone. Like they've left. They're not in the company anymore. They've moved on to some other project, and they don't care about telling you anything about that code. And yet you've been asked to make some change, integrate it with some other system, fix a bug, whatever it is you've been asked to do to it. So you go into this code you've never seen before, and you start working on it. You sort of, maybe you use some architectural tools to try to understand how the code is organized. You get in, you ultimately figure out what change that you think you need to make. How do you make sure you haven't broken anything else? You didn't get any unit tests. You don't know even what all scenarios that code was designed to be used for. So we have a new feature in Visual Studio 2015 that I really like called IntelliTest. And IntelliTest is, I don't know if anybody had ever heard of PEX. PEX is a technology put out by MSR a few years ago that we've now productized into a feature called IntelliTest. So if I click on, I can click in a method and say run IntelliTest. And what IntelliTest does is it's a solution solver. It goes in, looks at your code in detail, looks at every branch, every piece of conditional logic, and generates sort of every interesting case of, here's a set of inputs that cause different outputs, and here's the outputs that they cause. This is sometimes called characterization testing. Let me go find everything that might cause a different output and generate a set of tests that then generate those outputs. So I've just run IntelliTest, and it's just done that. So it is 100% exhaustive. It has covered, it's not like it's just guessing. It, by analyzing the branch logic in the code and tracing that back to the function inputs, it is able to tell you the complete and precise set of inputs that exercise it. So for this particular function, we found that there are seven different tests, and I can see a couple of them are throwing exceptions. That's interesting. So that might be intended behavior in the code. Some are not. And here we can see the test method that it has actually generated. And it's listed all the various inputs. So in this case, includes allowance is false. Location is location.metro. Monthly allowance is illegible. It's the font, 1U. And employee, et cetera. So those are all the conditions that generate a specific output, and it has asserted that should generate the output of 0. And in fact, of course it did, because it characterized the code that way. I can then save these tests in my project and then just run them as part of my normal unit testing process. So as I'm making my changes, I am hopefully writing new unit tests for the behavior that I am exposing, but I've got these existing unit tests to be able to capture all of the pre-existing behavior and make sure that I'm not breaking anything. So that's really cool. All right, let's sort of set that aside. So when you think about quality, an important part of quality is code reviews. And I see increasingly more and more people doing code reviews these days. I know when I was getting started in software, the notion of code review was getting a bunch of people in a room and all staring at some projection of the code on the wall and walking through it. And thank God that's not the way we think about code review anymore. But instead, code review is much more of a collaborative process. The team shares their check-ins. In fact, it's not at all uncommon to have policies now that say, hey, nobody checks in anything that isn't code reviewed. Somebody on the team looks at it and gives it the okay to say, yep, that's a good piece of code, that's a good change. So in TFS and in Visual Studio Online, we've introduced this notion called pull requests. Pull requests are basically the Git equivalent of code reviews. I make a change, I request that it be merged into a branch, and that is a code review that people will look at. So here I've got, I've gone to the pull request tab, and I've got a pull request that is assigned to me to go look at. So I'll look in there. And that's going to show me who created it. It was created by Sachin. I can see quickly the list of the history on this code review, all of the people who've commented on it, what comments that they left. I can switch over and look at the code, and I can see over here which files have been changed, what comments have already been left, and very quickly navigate to the files with those comments in it. I can also reply. So I can just say something simple like, I agree with Ed. And I've left my comment. I can also, I'm showing up over here on the list of reviewers, and I can change my sort of evaluation of this code review. I can approve it. I can approve it with suggestions. I can wait on a response from the author. I can reject this. And all of this can then be used as a policy and say, hey, you know, unless there's approvals, it can't be checked in. I also got some nice features like the ability to ping people. So if it's my code review and I need to get this code in and I want to be able to get people to finish up those code reviews, a real simple email that will email a summary of the code review with links for somebody for the reviewers to get back into the experience and complete their code review. When the code review finally passes, I can click complete pull request. That will automatically merge the code in and send it. We've also got work items, so I can see the tasks and user stories that are associated with this code review. So, you know, this sort of ability to do, or the practice of doing code reviews, is a very important part of modern modern development practices and getting quality code. This is our Git experience. We've got a Team Foundation version control experience as well that's hosted in Visual Studio, not in the web. We're in the process of bringing those two together so that we'll have TFVC and Git both in the web and in Visual Studio. Right now, Team Foundation version control is in Visual Studio. Git is in the web. As I say, they'll be coming together. So the next sort of piece I want to talk about in terms of quality is technical debt. So technical debt is cruft. It's stuff that grows in your code base over time. Sometimes people call it bit rot. Code seems to age. It gets old. It gets brittle. Why does that happen? It happens because changes get made that are sometimes not fully baked, not fully vetted, not sort of fully scrubbed. And over time, those things grow, and the quality of the code gradually goes down. Number of bugs go up. The amount of time it takes you to make changes goes up because there are more special cases and unexpected behaviors that you have to deal with. So that's an area that we've been thinking hard about and working on helping developers improve. There's a pretty popular open source solution, particularly popular in the Java world, called SonarQube. Has anybody heard of SonarQube? All right, not too many. It's not very well known in the .NET space, but I'll tell you, in the Java space, I recently saw a stat that something like 60 to 70% of Java projects use SonarQube for managing their technical debt. So we reached out to SonarSource, which is the company that makes SonarQube. It's an open source solution, but there's a commercial company behind the open source solution. We reached out to them to do a couple of things. One, we said, hey, we'd like to make Sonar work really well for .NET projects. And B, we'd really like to integrate it with TFS and Visual Studio Online and make a great combined experience for including technical debt management as part of your development process. So I've pulled up real quick the SonarQube dashboard on this My Travel project. We can see this is a C# project. It's got 9,300 lines of code, number of files, number of functions, classes, so just some basic code metric statement of what all do I have in here. Each of these are links. I can drill into it to enumerate them. It's also got code clone detection, so I can drill in and say, hey, 10.7% of the code in this project is duplicated. Duplication is bad. You should not be copy-pasting lots of redundant code around. You should refactor the code. Makes it easier to maintain. So I can drill in and say, wow, this file looks like it's got a lot of duplicated code. I can scroll over here, and I see this big old chunk of code that it says is duplicated. Oops. So I'm going to click on that bar. And one more time. There we go. Oops. Let's click to it where I can see it. So as it's duplicated by, so this file, I lost the name of the file, but it says it's duplicated in Bing Work Items Mappings.cs, lines 15 through 73. So I can click over there and see in Bing Work Item Mappings.cs. Sure enough, there's exactly the same code over there. This would be a very smart thing for me to look at the possibility of refactoring either into a base class because these two share an awful lot of public methods, or if they were more significant, maybe just the method bodies. So that's one form of technical debt, is a bunch of copied code around that becomes hard to maintain. They also do code complexity metrics to help you understand where your most unmaintainable code is. And then static analysis. So here I've got the results of a static analysis run. This is based on, we've plugged in FXCOP, plus the Sonar Source has taken our Roslyn engine and gone and built some additional rules for assessing .NET code. In fact, here's a funny piece of trivia. It turns out in writing these new Roslyn rules for Sonar, they found a bug in Roslyn using the rules. So Roslyn was one of their test bases for testing their new rules, and they found a bug in the process. So that was pretty cool. So if I click in, I can look at, you know, my major warnings. And so here's an example. It says handle the exception rather than swallow it with an empty statement. I can drill into that code. Sure enough, there's a catch exception that does nothing whatsoever. Eating exceptions is generally a pretty bad idea because inevitably it's an indicator of some kind of program misbehavior, and just ignoring it silently is probably going to lead to bad things down the road. So there's hundreds of rules in here to capture various things that you could be doing better. One of the cool things about this is they support build over build diffs. So, you know, the thing about technical debt is it's often super hard to think, oh, I'm going to go clean up all my technical debt, because it's sometimes years worth of work to go clean up everything that's accrued over time. So one of the things that they do that's really nice is the ability to set build baselines and say, hey, that build I'm going to call, you know, zero, and any new technical debt that comes up after that, I want that flagged, and then I'll sort of have a two-pronged strategy. Let me cap the creation of new technical debt, and then let me gradually burn down the technical debt that I have. So all of this is integrated with build. So our build system, you can now have tasks that will automatically generate the Sonar data that allow you to visualize it, trend it, look at build over build analysis, etc. So let's, talking about build, let's do a quick segue into builds. So in Team Explorer, as has been for a long time, we got a build node that has a bunch of build information, including the most recent builds you've run and your build definitions. So let's look at this build definition. Let's pull that up so that I can actually see it. And if I go to the build process, so this build is the same build you've been using for a long time, and I click on advanced, then I can see in here the work, the configuration changes that allow sonar to automatically capture and report build information up into the sonar dashboard. So very simple to just set this, this script inside your build settings and have your sonar dashboard automatically populated, visible in a nice, easy, handy web place for people to go to see it. So the other thing you'll notice is this thing is now called XAML build definition. So we have a, we've had a build system in TFS for years, which was based on the Windows workflow engine. That's why it's called the XAML build system, because at the base of it is a XAML description of your build process. The we've gotten a lot of feedback over the last many years. One of those pieces of feedback is that thing is just too hard to customize. Like, I don't know Windows workflow. I don't know XAML that well. I don't want to get in there and have to figure out this very, you know, multi-thousand line XAML file build workflow. I just want to do something very simple. That was one of among many pieces of feedback about the build system. So we've been working to build sort of the next generation of our build system, which we've been calling Build VNext. It is in preview now and will become widely available within the next week or two to everybody who wants to try it. I, of course, have it enabled on this count, so I was going to show you a little bit about it. So let's start by, let's go here. So first thing to observe is Build VNext has a web-based experience. You can get to it from, it's integrated into Visual Studio, but it's got a nice web experience as well. There's a few reasons for that. One is some of the people who manage builds don't use Visual Studio, either because they're build managers or whatever, or because they're Java devs or Node.js devs or JavaScript devs or any kind of other dev that happens to not use Visual Studio. So we have a web experience. And instead, replacing that sort of complex XAML workflow for the build is now a very simple linear set of tasks to execute. So I've got here a build definition that that does a Visual Studio build, runs some unit tests, does an Xcode build, does a Maven build, does an Android build, signs the Android build, and then sends the binaries off to the Xamarin test cloud to run some device tests on it. So one of the things you might want to, you might observe here is, wow, that's not just Visual Studio. So our new build system has a cross-platform build agent, runs on Linux, runs on Mac, and we've built already pre-populated a bunch of build tasks to do a lot of the things that you might expect. Gradle and Gulp and Ant and CMake and on and on. So lots of stuff, very cross-platform, easy to customize and plug into. Each one of these, as part of the definition of that task, has a set of properties and a UI that can automatically gather those properties. So this is the set of properties that an Xcode build needs. Here's the set of properties that an Android signing task needs, et cetera. We also, let's see, next thing I want to show is, you know, we still have triggers like we had in the existing build engine. You can do CI builds, you can do schedule builds. Another new feature in the new build system is history. So one of the complaints about our XAML build system is the build definition isn't versioned. It's sort of in the server and not versioned. So the new build system provides a way for me to see all of the changes that have been made to the build definition. I can also diff those and see exactly what changes. So these are the properties that you saw in those forms. See exactly what changes were made, when they were made, and enable me to have much better control over the evolution of my build templates. And lastly, I've talked about extensibility, and I've talked about cross-platform and interoperability. So one of the things we've done is made it so that our build system can pull from anything. It can pull, of course, from our Git repos in TFS or VS Online, or from Team Foundation Version Control. But now you can hook it up to other sources. So as an example of that, we've added a GitHub source. So all of this, as I say, is completely extensible. Plug in whatever you want. And now I can fill in my information and run CI builds, for instance, off of a GitHub account if I want to. All right. I think that was all I wanted to show you for build. New build system incorporates pretty much all the customer feedback we've gotten over the last few years. I think people are really going to like it. I encourage you to check it out, give it a try. All right. Let's go to the next section. Sorry. So the I can sort of plan what I'm going to build. I can build it, and the next thing is, how do I get it into production quickly, repeatably, reliably, etc. And there's a bunch of sort of things that go into the broader process that is release management, and those include things like packaging, provisioning. So how do I get the hardware that I'm going to deploy something onto? Validation, so testing of the work in various environments, whether it's functional validation or performance validation. The ability to script and automate the flow and manage the approval process of the code through multiple stages. I might have a pre-production server, an integration server, a production server that I want to kind of be able to manage through. So all of those things together constitute what I think of as the process of release management. It's how I get the stuff from the developer desktop into ultimately the production environment. So let's go back to demos. Here we go. All right, let's... So we've got a release management system today in TFS, and what I'm going to show you here is kind of the next generation of that release management system. If you haven't checked out what we have today, it's I encourage you to. It's in, I think we first shipped it in TFS 2013.1, I think, is the first version it shipped in. But let's talk about sort of the next generation. So one of the big changes we're making in the next generation is we're moving away from, over time, it'll take probably a couple years to get there fully, but from a rich WPF release management client to a web-based release management client for a lot of the same reasons that I described with the build stuff. So there's a new release tab. In the web UI, this will be both for Visual Studio Online and for TFS on-prem, that allows me to manage my releases. So here I've got a release, I've got sort of a dashboard of my releases, starting with my apps down sort of, or my release pipelines down the left-hand side, and my various stages across. So let's say I want to drill into a specific release. I want to look at my shuttle CRM, and I can see that the 2.0 version of that app is in the dev environment. The 1.7 version of that app is in the QA environment, and the 1.5 version of that app is in the production environment. So super easy for me to see which releases are in which environment. Super easy for me to see if an environment deployment has failed, the tile turns red. I can drill in to this environment and see all of the releases that have gone on in this environment. So this is over, you know, the last couple days we've been doing releases. I can see the various versions. I can see some of the early ones failed. and I can drill in to an individual release and see all of the information about that release, who started that release, when, what was released, etc. I can also go into the logs and see exactly what steps were taking, how they were approved, whether it was automated or manual, etc. So a pretty nice ability to drill through all of the data about a release, all of my apps, which environments they're in, and the success of those various environments. I can also, it's super easy to edit these directly here in the web UI. And you'll notice this UI looks pretty similar to the build UI. In fact, it's the same underlying pipeline, and I can interchange tasks between my build pipeline and my release management pipeline. Because quite honestly, sometimes I've just got a small app and a small team that's kind of not sort of mission critical production, and I just want to do a simple continuous deploy. Every check-in goes through some validation and then deploys. I don't need a release management workflow in multiple environments and stuff like that. I just drop the tasks into my build pipeline to deploy everything, run my validation tests, and I'm good. And then in other cases, it's a mission-critical app with lots of environments and sort of validations and approvals and sign-offs. And then I can jump into release management. Construct the environments. It's relatively easy to add a new environment, so maybe I want to add a perf environment. Drag that up because I want it between QA and prod, and then I can just drop in and start adding tasks. So maybe I want to do an Azure Cloud Service deployment, and I want to run some PowerShell, and maybe I want to do some testing, etc. All as part of my pipeline. I fill out the parameters on it, save it, and I've added a new stage to my pipeline. All right, which actually brings me back. I skipped one thing I wanted to show. Let me go back. I think it's this one. So as I mentioned, one of the important things you want to be able to do in a release management process is validation. Sometimes that validation is manual. I want to have some QA people go run a set of tests. Often, I hope, and a very important part of that is automated. So I want to be able to have a build process and a release management process that automatically kicks off a set of functional tests, a set of performance tests. So we've added the ability in 2015 to have to be able to run, in fact, in a distributed test environment, a set of functional tests, report those tests back, succeed or fail the release management process on the success or failure of those tests. We have the ability to run load tests as well as part of the release process, validate if the load, if the scale of your application, the reliability of your application is good, and gate the success or the continuation of the release management process on that. So they are just tasks. So here's an example of a build definition that does exactly this. It builds your solution. It runs some unit tests. It runs a PowerShell to deploy your app onto your application under test machines. It then copies the test files out to some test machines, deploys the Visual Studio test agent onto those machines, and then runs this distributed functional test on your machine. And next thing I wanted to show, this all shows up in your release. Oops, sorry. As a set of runs. This is a new feature in our test management product that allows you to take these automated runs that are occurring as part of your release process and capture the results that allow me to then go through and examine the runs, see sort of what the outcome of those various test executions were. So in this case, that was some manual ones, but you'll see tests passed and failed with the priority of the tests, et cetera. I can drill into the individual tests, see which ones passed and failed, and assign these tests for someone to explore. So we give you a very nice ability to sort of track all of these tests. Ultimately, we plan to increase this, add functionality here to be able to do things like find flaky tests so that when tests, some tests sort of just fail randomly. They'll succeed sometimes, they'll fail sometimes. Those things can be incredibly frustrating for a developer because you're asked, hey, go investigate this test failure, and then you go try it, and of course the test runs just fine and pisses you off. So we're going to add analysis to be able to detect things like that, warn you of, hey, these are tests that are flaky. You need to go fix the underlying tests so that they pass or fail regularly or consistently. All right, so that's sort of release management. I'm going to come back for my last section. So I talked about the fourth phase of DevOps is monitor and learn. So modern DevOps, a very, very important part of it is understanding what's happening to your application in production, understanding what's happening to your users, what they're doing, why they're doing it, trying new things, learning how those changes affect the success of your application. So let's do a lap around application insights. So this last week at Build, we announced the public availability or the public preview of Application Insights. I strongly encourage you to go check it out. It is transformative. In fact, I was talking to, I got an email from a customer, I think it was about 2 weeks ago, who was playing around with the private preview and said that, you know, they tried it out just to see what would happen and that within 10 minutes, one of the developers on his team found a bug in his application that he didn't know was there. And he was just like, holy cow, I had no idea that, you know, the app was throwing these exceptions on a fairly regular basis. There was nothing end user reported problem, but fundamentally the app was broken. So I encourage you to check it out. You can go, it's in the Azure portal, so go to azure.microsoft.com and see the experience. So let's do a quick lap around. All right, we will. So here I've got, I've taken the back end of my MyShell app, which is just an ASP.NET web application, and I've instrumented it with Application Insights. And App Insights gives you, with sort of no effort, a basic overview of what's happening in your app. So I can see what the average server response time of my app is, what the browser page load time is, how many server requests I'm getting, how many of those requests are failing. So a super simple, quick look. Application Insights also has availability monitoring. So these are points of presence around the world that will ping your app on a regular basis. So here I can see the vast majority of them are failing. I'll notice I'm getting two different response times, one that's significantly longer than the other. When I drill in, that's easy to see why. Because I've got one location pinging from Paris and one location pinging from San Antonio, and the app is in San Antonio, so the San Antonio one is much faster than the Paris one, and that's just internet latency. I can also drill into the failures. So I can see my app is periodically failing. In fact, I've had 40 failed requests. There's no discernible pattern in that. I see that the most common failing thing is my search page. I also see that sometimes, not too often, some of my dependencies are failing. So here's my SQL failing and another website I depend on failing. So let's drill in, since it's 65% of my failures, let's drill into search and see what might be happening in search. So again, I see sort of a pattern of search failures, nothing really standing out to me, so let's drill in again. So here it's going to actually pull out of the diagnostic log each and every one of the exceptions thrown from the search page. And I can drill into one of those. And see, what the URL was, and I can see exactly what the exception was. I can drill into the exception and see the stack trace. Here I've got it with just my code. If I want to see it with the infrastructure code, I can unclick the show just my code, and I can see all the ASP.NET MVC code sort of wrapped around where my failure in the code is. So a very, very rich sort of diagnostic experience to be able to identify failed requests and get to those failures. So in addition to sort of diagnostics to understand where your app is failing, we also provide usage data to help you understand what's going on in your application. So again, I'm looking right now, I've got my lens of the web server on right now. So I can see how many users I have. I see I've got 10,670 users with a bunch of sessions, a bunch of page views. I can see searching for a cab is the number one most common request. And on down, I can see what country they're coming from. So I'm getting 10,000 from the US, 2,000 from Germany and the UK, a few from Australia. I can see what browsers people are using. I can see what my daily active user count is. I'm getting 1,300 per day. And you know, one of the things as I'm looking at these custom events that I'm noticing is people, I got a lot of people searching for cabs, but if I look down to people actually purchasing a cab, ordering a cab, it's small. So it's less than a quarter of the people who are purchasing cabs who are looking for cabs are actually purchasing them. So as a business, I might be pretty concerned about that and wanted to drill into it. So I will segue then to give me one second. So that was sort of a view on the server side. Application Insights also monitors the device side. So here what I've done is switched over to my device, and I'm looking at my my iOS app running, and I can see, you know, I've got 1,000 sessions on iPhone 6. I've got 700 on iPhone 6 Plus, some 5Ss. I see a bunch of different locations that they're getting used from. I can see, what my top crashes on the iPhone device is. So if I want to drill into top crashes, I'll see here a list of my crashes, when they're happening. I can drill into my crashes and see what devices and sort of information about those crashes. And the first thing that jumps out to me is, oh man, it looks like if I look at sort of crashes by version of my app, 56.7% of my crashes are on my latest app. So it is highly likely that I introduced a new bug into the latest version of my app. And I'm going to want to drill into that to find out what it is. So just like I can do on the website, I can drill into the specific crash, pull up the exceptions, and see exactly where in my iOS code that crash is. So I've got my Objective-C call stack right here showing me where the problem is. Another cool feature of Application Insights is I can now correlate this telemetry to other things. So in this case, I want to see all the telemetry for this user session leading up to that crash. So when I click on that, I get this pane here, which shows all of the page views and custom events that led up to that exception that helps me understand all of the things that user was doing before they experienced a crash. So all of this is about helping you build an application that is reliable, that delivers on the business requirement that you have, and delivers a great customer experience. And that is, believe it or not, the end of my demos. Real quick, I was going to switch back to slides and wrap up. So we're about out of time. So what I've been showing you is a bunch of capabilities in Team Foundation Server and Visual Studio Online. It's a long set of capabilities, covers just about everything you could want. It's interoperable. We support Android, iOS, .NET, Windows, Eclipse, etc. I'm going to skip this because I don't want to hold you guys any longer. We're continuing to evolve this. Got lots and lots of new capabilities coming. Every 3 weeks we ship more. And over the next few months, you'll see tons of new stuff coming out. And I strongly encourage you to check out visualstudio.com. You can download Visual Studio 2015. You can get a Visual Studio Online account and check out everything that we're doing. Thank you very much.